Welcome to Blocked and Reported. I'm Katie Herzog, and joining me today, while Jesse is very, very drunk, we have two very special guest hosts, Kat Rosenfield and Phoebe Maltz-Bovey. Kat is a critic and the author of fantastic murder mysteries, including most recently, You Must Remember This, and Phoebe is a columnist and editor at the Canadian Jewish News and a co-host of its Bonjour Chai podcast, as well as...
Hi.
Oh, overly. I already fucked it up.
Yeah.
That makes sense. It is a Jewish podcast, not an Indian podcast. First correction of the show, Bonjour Chai?
Yeah. Well done. Okay, well done.
All right. Thank you. She is also the author of the 2017 book, The Perils of Privilege, which was certainly ahead of its time and I think would be of great interest to many of our listeners today. And together they host the podcast Feminine Chaos, Kat and Phoebe. Phoebe and Kat, welcome to Blocked and Reported.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, you two, I should say, you two are actually sort of responsible for this podcast because the three of us are in a group chat with Jesse. And you started Feminine Chaos in what year was it?
2018, I think.
Yes, that was the first Blogging Heads version of it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was Blogging Heads. So you guys started your show, and we're on this group chat together, and it was just like, I think Jesse and I were just straight up jealous. And so we decided to team up together and make this show. So as a thanks to you both, I've decided to give you his third of the money.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much. I love that you guys started your podcast after us and then immediately exceeded us by like an order of magnitude in success. This is like where the student exceeds the master or whatever.
You know what we had going for us was COVID. We just got extremely lucky with the timing.
Also, Jesse's illustrious sex appeal. It's legendary.
Yes, Kat is also a comic. All right, so we've got a great show planned today. What I would like to talk to you both about is home renovations because we are all in that stage of life, but I suppose we should save that for in person. So instead, we're going to discuss issues that are close to all of our hearts, straight women, and scandals in the world of young adult literature. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you both something that I've been thinking about a lot recently. This is something that Andy Mills brought up on the show when he was on last month, and he basically argued that Elon Musk buying Twitter destroyed Twitter's power as a mechanism for cancellation. So I'm wondering what you both think about that. And I'd like you to think about this in the context of one specific culture war issue, and that's Me Too. So Kat, let's start with you. You recently wrote a column for Unheard titled, How Me Too Became Too Cringe for America, Have Rape Allegations Lost Their Power? So how are you thinking about this?
So that column was pegged to the release of Christine Blasey Ford's new memoir, which is coming out a bit late in time to jump on the train, the Me Too train.
Yeah, we have moved on.
Seriously. So I was really interested to see when this memoir came out. Like, it didn't get very much advance buzz. And then on the day of, you know, there were a few reviews, but it was nothing like the kind of, I mean, frankly, I expected like a lot more fanfare for this sort of Me Too folk hero who's releasing a book or, you know, her first book. And instead it was almost like people were kind of uncomfortable and embarrassed at even having to look back at how we all behaved at the moment when Christine Blasey Ford was such a big deal. She's like that high school friend who like, you love her, but you don't want to hang out with her because you know she's going to bring up the really embarrassing thing that you did like when you were 17. And you're like, oh, please, I just don't want to talk about it anymore.
Specifically bring it up in a congressional hearing.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So, you know, I do think that like we've seen Me Too kind of come and go, right? And in 2019, we had the books, what is it, Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow, and then the other one, She Said. So we had the movement, and then we had the books about the movement, and then we had the movie about the books about the movement. And now, you know, and then people were done. People were like, you know, all right, enough with sexual assault. Let's all get obsessed with race. And instead of believe women, it was like, shut up, Karen.
And remarkably quickly.
Yeah.
Especially because it was white women all of a sudden went from being the victim to the villain.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes. So now in the cold light of day, I think that for Christine Blasey Ford to show up, like, and her book is just basically retelling the story of how she decided to come forward and testify that, you know, Brett Kavanaugh jumped at her at a party in 1982. It's like, we were at the point where we were sort of trying not to think about that, where you're looking around and you're like, okay, you know, in hindsight, perhaps things all got a little out of hand. And so I was just interested to see that, yeah, she got this very lukewarm reception. Even the reviews of her book that were kind of like dutifully positive were not glowing. And the New York Times was like outright disdainful. It called her book prosaic.
Okay. Yeah. So I found your piece about this really interesting. And this came out at roughly the same time as this piece this week in New York Magazine about Andrew Huberman. Do one of you want to explain this? I have to admit, I did not read all 10,000 words about it. I was more interested in the reaction to it. So will one of you give the sort of short version of what this piece was about?
I can try. Andrew Huberman is a bro podcaster as well as a Stanford professor. So he wears two hats, and he wears a third hat, but not the other sort of hat lower down on his body that he maybe should have worn. but basically, this is a great big expose. Was it Carrie Howley wrote
yeah.
it? Okay. In the cut about how basically all the while he's preaching self-help and optimization, he's also been he's been doing some non-ethical non-monogamy with a bunch of different women.
Which I'm struggling to figure out how these two things are in conflict with each other.
Yeah, that's the confusing bit, right? So do these things have anything to do with each other? And I guess I came away from this thinking, wouldn't it help your sort of cred in that world and that type of podcasting if you are a bit of a cad? I don't know.
Well, so that's what I found interesting about the response to this piece. Again, so I didn't read this piece because I have a rule about not caring about podcasters' love lives. I don't think podcasters should have love lives. It's disgusting. I'm not going to read about it. But I did follow the reaction on Twitter. And what was interesting to me about this is that it was my feed was not evenly divided among people saying that this guy is a dirtbag and a sleaze. The majority of the commentary that I saw was people saying, A, this is fucking cool, or B, who cares? That was the majority opinion that I saw, was people saying this shouldn't be a story. And that to me shows some real shift since the height of the Me Too movement, where any not even non-famous person's sex life could be held up for scrutiny at any time by the media. And this guy is legitimately famous. And now we have a lot of people saying, who cares? Even if what he did was, I mean, I don't think it's particularly cool to like cheat on five different women at one time. He comes across, from what I can tell, as really a pretty big douchebag. But to me, that says something, that we have really moved on from this moment. If the majority opinion is this should not be a story, this is a hit piece and this should not be a story.
Well, I also wonder whether we are literally recording this at the in the week of that exact vibe shift, because The Cut also published this piece about the case for dating older men or marrying older men. I don't have this open. The case for marrying an older man by Grazie Sophia Christie. And it's a very, I mean, I don't know whether it's like a sort of dime square type aesthetic or politics, but basically it's very much post-feminist. It's something between being a kept woman, being a trad wife, and advocating for that. Mm-hmm. And it's not even advocating for that in the name of feminism. It's just plain advocating for that. And I just thought it was interesting that The Cut would feature that.
The Cut has really figured out the formula for how to still have an article go viral on Twitter.
Yes.
I'm not sure that any other outlet can consistently do it. But just in the past couple of months, we've had, you know, the big non-monogamy piece, the polyamory piece that people were talking about. I think people are unfortunately still talking about this Huberman piece, this older men piece.
Totally.
Emily Gould's essay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Huberman piece, you can really sort of like, you can feel the ghost of the sordid expose that it was supposed to be, like lurking in the background, unfulfilled, because it never quite got there. And I think that, I don't know. I mean, I really love Carrie Howley's writing, and I enjoyed that article like on its literary merit alone because it was fun to read. But journalistically, it does feel really kind of thin. And it strikes me that like there would be a version of this article, and I think it may be in 2019 or 2018, at the sort of height of Me Too badness, where the writer could have hit the ball much more, and at the end you would come away believing that he is basically a sex criminal as opposed to just like a really bad boyfriend. But, you know, instead, I think that the kind of big reaction that I saw with respect to this piece so much was like people would get to the end and be like, I was waiting for the other shoe to drop the whole time and nothing ever happened. Like, what did this guy actually do? This isn't really news. It's just bad.
She should have inserted the word trauma a few dozen times.
maybe I'm giving her too much credit, but I think maybe she had too much integrity to kind of like drag the article into that territory. Or I'm just saying this because I really like her work. But yeah, like this piece is not what it would have been a few years ago. And the reaction to it was also not what it would have been a few years ago. I think that a few years ago, people would have basically, you know, wanted this guy to suffer like professional and social death.
Oh yeah,
for having been just non-ethically non-monogamous. Although I also have to say, like, in a very predictable way, like there was nothing that this guy did that he did not advertise he was going to do in advance, like multiple times. And the fact that the women are supposedly like very surprised by this, I don't know. But I mean, they're now in their group chat with their Care Bear names, and I wish them well.
Another recent example that I think says something about the moment that we're in is that of Yasha Monk. So Yasha was accused, was this maybe 6 weeks ago or so, 2 months ago, he was accused of rape on Twitter. The woman who accused him, her name is Celeste Marcus. She's a managing editor at the magazine Liberties. And she wrote a piece detailing this alleged sexual assault that she experienced. And then she didn't name her perpetrator. And then later she went on Twitter and she named Yasha. And immediately after that, after she named him, Yasha was a contributor to The Atlantic, and The Atlantic announced that he'd been fired. Yasha has denied this, I should add, and as far as I know, his actual employer, not The Atlantic, but Johns Hopkins University, has not taken action against him. But I think a year or two ago, or it's definitely 4 years ago or 5 years ago, this would have been a multi-week media saga. This would have been the fucking talk of Twitter, because Yasha is the sort of public intellectual who a lot of people who would have been like the former blue check Twitter, the sort of, you know, the sort of progressive journalist can't stand. And maybe they've all fled from Twitter. Maybe this was a huge story on Blue Sky, but this just wasn't that big a story on Twitter.
I think I might have a different theory about it that has nothing specifically to do with Twitter. And maybe it is too galaxy brained, but I'm going to try anyway, which is that there's just too much else going on. And this is just caring about sort of women as victims, especially like well-off white women as victims, or, you know, upper middle class white women, whatever. It's just too many sort of topics ago. So I'm thinking about this is where it gets really galaxy brained, like the whole October 7th sexual assaults discourse, right? People were saying, oh, isn't it so surprising that progressives aren't, you know, up in arms about this. Mm-hmm. Well, up in certain arms, that's something else. But I didn't find this surprising at all, not just because of how things fall in terms of culture wars and Israel-Palestine stuff, but like specifically in terms of the Me Too angle. Like, why wouldn't the usual suspects care? Who are the usual suspects? Like, the usual suspects moved on to race, then they moved on to trans issues, right. Now they moved on to Gaza. That is old news for them. Anything about any group of women who are understood in this framework as privileged, I was not surprised, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it does seem pretty clear that the moment has passed. And it is, there's something a little bit, I don't know if it's depressing, maybe just sort of telling that the things that the culture seems to care about really are fads. And now we're in the Israel-Palestine cycle. Personally, I do not like this cycle. This is a very bad cycle.
Yeah, I want this one to end. This is worse than slap bracelets.
Okay, Phoebe. Well, since we're talking about women, let's move on to your segment. You are currently writing a book on female heterosexuality. Is that right?
Yes, I am. So the book I'm writing, and it's with Signal, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House Canada. It's tentatively titled The Last Straight Woman.
Oh, nice.
Thank you. And it's in reference, I should say, it seems ridiculous to say tongue-in-cheek about something you're doing, but whatever it
it's
is,
about me.
It's about Kat. Okay, it's a biography of Kat. So it's in reference to this idea that straight women, not unlike lesbians, are a dying breed, and that this is not fashionable anymore. It's not a thing in society anymore, and yet here I am, last one standing. That sort of thing. So it's some people, when I've said I'm writing a book about straight women, have said, sort of have thought that I'm trying to like make there be more straight women, and that is not, I am neutral on the number of straight women there are.
Do we actually need to make a lab designated to creating more straight women? Are they a dying breed?
Maybe one in Wuhan.
A bioweapon worse than the world has ever seen.
Okay, well, Phoebe, what do you mean when you say straight women are disappearing?
Yes, so there's this idea that straight women are disappearing, but it's not entirely true. So most people, including most women, do still say in polling and such in the US and elsewhere that they're straight. But new polls from Gallup and elsewhere have shown in recent years that there are increasing percentages in the US and elsewhere identifying as LGBTQ with some extra letters sometimes in some form. And what the polling really shows is that the big shift is coming from young women. So for those of us of our generation familiar with sort of 1990s sex panics, there was always this kind of discussion that like once you could live as a gay man, all the men would just leave their wives and rent a big house together on Fire Island. And that did not happen. That did not happen. But straight women, like women who will call themselves straight in a survey, there are not so many as there used to be.
And do you think that this is because there are, in fact, fewer straight women, that women are less likely to be heterosexual or identify as heterosexual because of because they actually want to have sex with women? Or is this – are they doing it to be cool?
Yes and no. And it's really, really hard to figure this out in terms of numbers because you can it's very different. So like if somebody says that they are part Indigenous, you can look that up. People can look into this. There can be an answer.
There's a whole website.
Exactly. If there's a married woman married to a man who says she's bisexual, I mean, what are you going to do? There's no like lie detector test sent to her house.
It's extremely easy to fake this. Although I will say I have kind of changed my thinking on this. I used to think that lots of women who said they were bisexual but never actually had any same-sex experience were faking it. And I've sort of changed my opinion on this in conversation with sex researchers. And some sex researchers even think that the concept of sexual orientation doesn't apply to females the way it does to males. And I talked about this on the show a little bit last week. This sort of comes up frequently. But I have sort of shifted my thinking on this to the point where I've started to think that there are a lot of women who just sort of say they're bi because there's some cultural capital, or say they're pan because there's some cultural capital there. But I also think that most women are probably a little bit bi.
Oh, and I
include lesbians in that category too, which is a little bit offensive. But
okay,
everybody wants to talk.
Please.
So can I just like quickly jump in here? I've just been writing something about this. It's not out yet, but I think that there is this interesting thing happening here, where because sexual orientation, like it used to be that you said, well, here's my sexual orientation, and it really did have like a direct connection to who you wanted to physically engage with. But at this point, like the idea of sexual orientation is in fact an idea in a lot of senses. Like it exists for a lot of us in this theoretical realm where it's like you're being asked, who are you attracted to? And I think that can take a lot of different forms. Like there's the idea of, you know, who do you theoretically not object to sleeping with? And then there is the question of like, what kind of porn do you like watching if you like porn? Or like, what kind of fantasy scenarios do you find exciting? And then like at at another end of the spectrum, there's the question of, and what would it be like if you were actually physically like in a bed, like with your naked body pressed up against a person's naked body? Like, does that change things? But young people, especially who are the ones who are identifying as bisexual in like droves right now, you know, a lot of them, their coming of age and like their sexual and social awakening is happening online. It's happening like outside of physical space. And so, of course, they conceive of it in a way that has little to do with like, whose body parts do I want inside me?
Basically. Yeah, they're not That's having true. Sex at all.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard that they're all in, or no, not incels, vol cells. Yes. Yes.
So, too many aspects of this. But so, yeah. So, this new polling actually came to my attention via a Catherine D, aka default friend, quote tweet of an NBC tweet sharing the new polling. And this was specifically about the number of young women identifying as bisexual. So she wrote, "This is a meaningless difference unless it's reflected in their behavior, not just their identification habits. Ask me how many bisexual friends I have who haven't so much as seen another woman naked, forget had sex with one, keep it moving." So that's kind of the view of like, it's all nonsense. And I don't think that that's it exactly. And especially because there are, you know, people know their sexual orientation sometimes, very often, in fact, before they have sex with anybody. But also conversely, you get things like the woman in everybody's favorite polyamory memoir, More. There's a part where she tries a threesome with another woman because a sexually adventurous woman just does that sort of thing, but she can't get herself to be sort of wired to enjoy it. And it's really hard to read because she's just so sort of miserable through it. And it's also the second time that she does this, right? Like this is...
Does she consider herself bisexual?
So, well, that's where... Okay. So she has a line where she says, "Maybe an FFM threesome would be a safe way to test the depths of my bisexuality." There is no bisexuality. However, because friction is friction, she is brought to orgasm in this by the woman in this threesome. And that does not seem... to me, to indicate anything profound about bisexuality. But I really do want to talk about the fluidity thing because I have like a really weird take on it.
Okay, before you get to that, I want to talk about this.
Yeah.
Pause on that for just a second. The fact that she was able to orgasm with a woman to me says basically nothing. Let's just envision for a second. Let's all imagine for a second that we're in prison. We're males in prison. We are heterosexual.
This is my favorite fantasy scenario.
This is sort of what I mean when I say that sexuality can be contextual. A dude in prison who gets a blowjob from another man in prison isn't necessarily doing it because he's bi or gay. He's doing it because that's the only outlet available to him.
Right, right.
I'm imagining a story about a guy who intentionally commits crimes to be sent to prison so he can get blowjobs from men.
This is your next YA book, Kat.
Please. Probably not racy enough for YA. Anyway, continue.
The fluidity thing. So there is definitely a theory that all women are bi or a little bit bi or a lot bit bi, whatever. And I can get why anybody who sleeps with women would be into that as an idea. And it is supposedly sort of the science of how women are wired. But and there is this idea that basically the sexual orientation as we understand it is really just the way it goes for men, sort of like the thing where we know the signs of a heart attack, but only the signs of a heart attack in men, right?
Right. Men are who has been studied.
Right, right. So what I've seen, so these ideas seem to mainly come in one way or another, and mainly sort of via the journalist Daniel Bergner, whose 2009 New York Times article, "What Do Women Want?" became a 2013 book with the same title. So it's Lisa Diamond's 2008 book, "Female Sexual Fluidity," and then research by Meredith Chivers and others on sort of basically which imagery women's eyes or crotches respond to with like wires affixed to them.
Right. So they put like electrodes on a woman's body and then measure the physical response when she's shown different porn, different erotic situations. I think in one scenario, women were watching like monkeys fuck. And mm-hmm. and their bodies actually physically responded to this. Mm-hmm. And I think an evolutionary biologist would say that this is like a protective mechanism, and because women are more likely to get raped, sex can be physically damaging to women. And so women's bodies just respond to basically anything.
They just rev up the machinery the second there's sex in the air. They're like, all right, I'm ready to go. It's exactly. It's going to happen.
Pretty much. And Chivers herself has said as much about this. So this idea that first, like, there was this idea that science has shown that, you know, women react anatomically to men, women, monkeys, and therefore are up for anything with any species or gender, whatever. And that may not, in fact, quite add up. And then this, the other book, Female Sexual Fluidity, that is a little bit more complicated. So it gets a lot of pushback these days because Lisa Diamond does not talk about trans people.
Oh, how dare she?
And because if you're talking about women's sexuality operating different from men's, obviously, and that is really her thesis, you're saying things that you are not allowed to say today.
That would really complicate things if you're talking about female sexuality, but you also include males under the category of females.
Right. Well, that's the thing. So, but what's funny is because she's in the book, she anticipates totally different pushback. She's worried that because she's arguing against a kind of born this way interpretation of sexual orientation, at least for women, she's worried that people are using her arguments to support conversion therapy or men hitting on lesbians, things like that. But that was not so. I had a sort of a different qualm with this book, which is that it's a study of 100 women who she found, I believe, in her gender studies classes. 11 of them are straight identified at the start of the project. So the finding that's it tells you, this book tells you a lot of interesting things about why women who don't identify as straight, even who identify as lesbian, will sometimes have relationships with men. It doesn't really tell you a whole lot about straight women. And that was something that really jumped out at me. And there are these moments in the book where she's talking about sort of the capacity straight women have to form a really intense friendship with another woman or to notice that a woman is beautiful and things like that. And it's true that straight men can be sort of homophobically weird about these things to do, you know, but I don't think that being interested and having and capable of having a close friendship with another woman or thinking a woman is beautiful, it speaks to any sort of special capacities. And then you see that in cases like in Moore or in some other books that I'm writing about where women will try, they believe that they need to, that all women like sex with another woman, surely, and then they try it. And it turns out that is not in fact the case.
Yeah, I think if you're trying to study female sexuality or especially straight women, the place to recruit for your studies is not a gender studies class.
That is another aspect of this, yes.
Go to a sociology class, psychology class, Spanish class, gender studies, that's really going to skew towards the, hairy-pitted lesbians.
I mean, I think there is definitely something observably true about there being more bi women than bi men. But so this actually isn't necessarily saying as much about women as it is about men and how men kind of aren't allowed to be bi as much. And so Jane Ward's book, Not Gay, which Jesse actually wrote about in 2016, it gets at the ways that men's sexual fluidity kind of exists in the world, but then gets categorized as something else.
I have a question about this as well. Like when a man identifies as bisexual, for instance, is there more of an expectation attached because of the way we conceive of male sexuality that he is going to follow that up by actually getting naked with and doing sex with a man?
Yes. And I think there's also the relative impact it would have on his popularity in the opposite sex dating world.
So the stakes are higher.
This is something that River Page said on the show last week. A man who is bisexual is much more likely to have sex with men, other men, because it is so easy for men to have sex with each other. You get on Grindr, you can literally order it up like DoorDash. It's incredibly easy for men to find other men to have sex with. And it just, if his goal is to have sex with women, it's a lot more work because men are much more likely to have these no strings attached sexual attachments than women are.
Yeah, so that actually gets to something else, which Trace, your researcher, helped me a lot with figuring out some data for, which more than I can possibly cite here. But basically, a lot of people will point to the fact that actually bi men and bi women form opposite sex marriages most of the time and say like, they're all faking it. But that doesn't really tell you that. What it tells you is that it is just, there are just a heck of a lot more straight people out there. It's just a lot easier actually sort of not quite gender neutrally, but it is a lot easier to just find an opposite sex partner. And if anything, I guess the math on this is such that bi people find same sex partners more than you would think, if anything, but just not 50% of the time or anything close.
I'm actually surprised that it's that bi men are more likely to end up with women than men. That surprises me. But bi women, for sure. I mean, I saw some polling, I believe, last year that found that a really tiny percentage of bisexual women are actually in married or monogamous relationships with women. It was something like around 1%. That's so really, it was like 90% are in relationships with men. And I will say, bis are sort of like the lowest point on the totem pole on the LGBTQ hierarchy, which is sort of ironic because they make up the greatest percentage. But bis are, and maybe this is changing, although I don't think it is, as long as I've been in queer communities, bi people are sort of the ones that get shit on the most.
Really? Not like, not the non-binary...
The non-binary wife?
I wouldn't even consider the non-binary wife to be actually a queer person. If the non-binary wife isn't a relationship.
That was so funny. The New York Times identified this as a queer couple, and I'm looking at the picture of them, and I'm like, what am I not understanding here?
Oh, but what turned out to be queer about them, it was this article, a lifestyle article, about couples who stay together but live apart. And this couple had lived apart for a time, a husband and his non-binary wife. And they had this whole thing that they're like queering relationships. And it turns out what the big revelation was, it wasn't that they were non-monogamous or something like that. It was that they decided that it's actually okay if they eat different things for dinner at night. So like anytime a straight man has a hamburger for dinner and his wife has a salad, they're queering heterosexuality, I guess.
If he was eating the salad and she was eating the burger, it would be queering. But if he's eating the burger and she's eating the salad, that's still straight. there was a similar cover story in some queer men's magazine, gay men's magazine. I don't know if it was The Advocate or it was a couple years ago. I'm sure that we talked about this in the group chat at the time. Nico Torticello and his wife. Do you guys remember this?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Kat, please describe this.
I think this is the guy who was on the show Younger, right?
Yeah. He's a like classically handsome.
Yes. So I love the show and I loved him on it. And when I started to catch wind of like what kind of a public presence he has, especially with regard to his activism as like a so-called queer idol. I was just, I don't know. It made me feel differently because he is like a very like traditionally masculine, good looking man, an adult human male in a relationship with a very conventionally attractive, conventionally feminine woman, adult human female. And yet they are, I guess, because of vibes, because of the aesthetic they adopted, because of what they say about themselves in magazines, they're like one of the biggest celebrity queer couples in America.
Yeah, I just pulled it up. It was from The Advocate. This was in 2017. This is what a queer family looks like. Nico Torticello and Bethany Myers are reinventing what it means to be a family. And there's a picture of an incredibly heterosexual looking, very attractive heterosexual couple on the cover of this magazine. And part of it is, I guess they both call themselves bisexual. I don't know if he's ever had a dick in his mouth or not. I wouldn't be too surprised. She says she's non-binary. I don't know if she actually dates women, but just by calling themselves non-binary, they qualify as a queer couple. I, of course, find this incredibly grating. And yet at the same time, I'm like struggling with this cognitive dissonance because I also believe that most women are like kind of bi. I do. Oh,
yeah. I mean, this is okay. So there's another thing. So are you both familiar with the writer Park McDougald?
Yes.
Okay, so he tweeted that in response to all of the stuff about all the women, the young women being bi, he wrote, "Bisexual just means Democrat." And I kind of think that it's silly, but I think that there's a little bit to that. And this kind of gets like a bit what Kat was talking about as well, about what people would really, really do if faced with options. And this is also, I hate to say it, a Sex and the City, wherein Charlotte is faced with options and in theoretical options and realizes that she is straight. But basically, I think it really is this new idea, like there's no such thing as an ally anymore. Like if you're a woman, a straight right. woman cannot be an there's no like straight ally. And I sort of wonder how much of this comes from this idea of like the straight woman in the gay bar as this really, really problematic interloper. But now if you say that you're some sort of queer, you can kind of be there and it's okay. And it's also just it, like there are just a lot of different incentives for women to say that there's something other than straight, even if by all accounts that is the thing they are. So there's also just this idea that if you're sexually adventurous, you have to at least speak to an open-mindedness mm-hmm. and maybe even engage in some proof, whatever. But I think there are just many incentives that – and it coexists with homophobia. It's not like either or. But I just don't think you get this with men. Like I don't think there even is the category of sexually adventurous for men. I think they are just like assumed to be up for whatever.
Mm-hmm. It's called men. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, it's called men. So, yeah. But I do think that this idea of bisexual as Democrat seems right, because I think there's something about if a woman says specifically that she's straight, where it sounds like she's saying something a little bit Karen-ish, a little bit judgmental, a little bit like she's squicked out, as versus like that she's into men in some sort of positive sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think Park is on to something there. I mean, with the exception of maybe Kristen Sinema, I don't think she's a Democrat anymore. I don't think it's as quite a like a one-to-one correlation as like NB means socialist. That's like there are no, you're not going to find a non-binary conservative. I went looking for one.
I remember that.
I found one, but he was a libertarian, so I don't think it really counts.
Yeah, how deep into the woods did you have to go?
I moved here. I moved to the woods just to try to find one. I think an interesting experiment would be to, everybody out here, go ahead and do this. Talk to your mom, or if your grandmother, if she's still alive, about her sexuality. Go next time you talk to your mom, ask her about her sexuality. I think a lot of this is just generational. And a lot of women, like if you look at polling, the number of people who call themselves bisexual or gay or lesbian is so much lower among the baby boom generation than this generation. And obviously a lot of that has to do with changing social norms and homophobia and acceptance. And I'm very curious to know if older people think that they would have, if they had grown up in a different generation, if their sexuality is something they would have explored more. I think that like I'm a dyke, right? I'm a 7 on the Kinsey scale. And I still believe that if I was born in 1949 or 1950, I probably would have ended up married to a man with children. Mm-hmm. Even as gay as I am now, I just don't think that would have been my life had it not been acceptable.
Right. Well, that's the whole sort of compulsory heterosexuality, the Adrienne Rich argument, that mm-hmm. women especially, it's not that there is more homophobia directed at women, but rather that there's more of an expectation to mm-hmm. find an opposite sex partner of women, right? And that has been receding. So whether you're talking about the opportunities of women to partner with other women or to just stay single or whatever, that is definitely much more possible than it was in the past, just socially possible, financially possible. And I just find like, so I watch a lot of old sitcoms, and just the amount of time that women characters on old sitcoms, like from the 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, talk about finding a man, like a man walks into the room and they're all like, which man is this, you know, like who's going to end up with that man, you know? And you just don't really get that anymore. And I think that's a good thing. And I think that's a good thing for women of all sexual orientations. But I think that the majority of women are still going to want to be with men. And I think that the reason I think that matters is that there's this way that feminism kind of evolved to basically say, let's get rid of men. Who needs them? We're better off without them. And I just don't think that that's going to work for the majority of women.
It is so funny that you mentioned the trope of the, like, you know, there's a man, who's going to get him, right? Because you don't really hear that anymore. The last time I actually experienced that trope, it was in real life instead of on TV. It was before my grandmother died. She was 105 when she went. So she'd been around for a while, long enough to see a lot of tropes come and go. And she was we'd been visiting with her at her assisted living facility, and we were taking her back to her room. And when we got in there, there was this like carpenter in there fixing a bookshelf or something that had broke. And she turns and looks over her shoulder at me and my mom, and she's like, I saw him first. my mom and I were both like, yeah, yeah, girl. He's all yours. Get it. you can have him. And that's how my grandmother fucked a carpenter. I'm just kidding.
Her last act on earth.
It would have been not a bad way to go.
I was going to say, that would be the perfect way to go. But anyway.
That's the Sex and the City episode right there. Okay, before we move on, I'm curious if for people who identify as 100% gay or 100% straight, I'm not talking about people in the middle, but people who really see themselves as either totally heterosexual or totally homosexual, do you ever have sex dreams about the opposite sex? Let me know. Write into the don't write my email address. I don't want to get it there. Write it in the comments. Put it on the Reddit. Let me know. What about you two? You want to weigh in on that?
I could, because I'm writing the straight women book. I'll admit it. I don't have sex dreams about women. And
interesting.
I don't have a political opposition to having them. Like, that's where this whole thing, yeah.
My theory is that it shows up in the subconscious, but Kat?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, I will admit that I do have sex dreams about women.
I knew it. I knew this about you. All right, anything else?
Well, Kat's going to be getting a lot more email after this
email
episode.
Email your dreams to Kat.
I was like thinking, what am I doing saying this out loud right now? No, it's fine. Yeah, no, hit me up with all your most disgusting emails. It'll be a nice break from the ones I usually get, which are boring.
You can read them on Feminine Chaos. All right, let's take a quick break. First, an ad for our free listeners, and then housekeeping.
Every day while we're on the road, people around us endanger themselves and others by using their phones while driving. They think they're hiding it, but we've all seen them and know exactly who they are. For instance, there's the sneak a peeker who darts their eyes between the road and their texts. There's also the got-a-ticketer, looking upset because they just got a ticket for using their phone while driving. And what about the fast scroller who can't drive 5 minutes without updating their social feeds? Or the nightlighter who has that mysterious glow illuminating the inside of their car after dark? Do any of these sound familiar? If they remind you of yourself or someone you know, rethink your behavior before you find yourself becoming the fender benderer, the veering off the roader, or, worst of all, the driver who killed someone. Put the phone away or pay. Paid for by NHTSA.
Do one of you guys want to do it? I can't do it anymore. I'm so sick of it.
This is Blocked and Reported. We, collectively, are a podcast. You can visit the Blocked and Reported website, which is blockedandreported.org, to sign up for... This is not a premium episode, right? This is a free
one. No, this is free.
Yeah. So go, you cheapazoid, go and sign up for the paid episodes at blockedandreported.org. There's also a Reddit, which I don't know the address of, but it exists.
Either.
It's very exciting over there on Reddit. And what else? Don't buy the merch.
That's pretty much it. If you want to support the show, as Kat mentioned, the best way to do it is to go to blockedandreported.org, where for just $5 a month and up, you can become a premium subscriber. You get at least 3 extra episodes of this podcast every month. Actually, 4 this month. We have one coming out tomorrow, I believe, on Candace Owens, the canning of Candace Owens. And you also get access to our great and growing community over there, the comment section. You get advance notice when we have live shows, and we do have some live shows coming up that we're not quite ready to announce, but looks like there's going to be a little bit of a mini tour this summer. And I think that's it. All right. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you. Is it time?
Is it time? You've got the wheel.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So I'm going to tell you guys a story about some drama in the young adult fiction community, which is something that I have been reporting on since 2017. This was like kind of my big break and breakout in the world of culture writing, reporting on toxic YA Twitter drama. And even though I have mostly moved on from writing about that, I still like to kind of peek back at that world from time to time because it's just an absolute snake pit. It's sort of like, you know, when you break up with your worst boyfriend, but then you still use an alt to look at his Instagram account or his Facebook just because it's like, okay, what kind of a mess has this guy gotten himself into?
No, he's a very successful bro podcaster.
That's right. That's right. So this story concerns a YA author named Molly X. Chang. And I'm wondering if that name sounds familiar to either of you.
Nope.
Vaguely.
Okay, I'm going to give you guys a hint. Molly was a supporting actor in the Kate Corrane Goodreads drama late last year. And Katie, you guys did a Bar Pod segment about this. And Phoebe, Yes. We also discussed this on Feminine Chaos.
Yes, so I do remember this. Kate Corrane was the debut author who had a sort of nervous breakdown and started review bombing other debut authors on Goodreads, as one does.
That is correct. Yes, as one does. And poor Kate Corrane is, I don't think she's institutionalized anymore, but she was briefly, and you know, we wish her well. But Molly Chang, the story is about Molly Chang, not Kate Corrane. She was one of Corrane's victims. Her debut novel is called To Gaze Upon Wicked Gods. And so you might remember that when Kate Corrane had her meltdown and did all of this review bombing, she was particularly criticized, not because she made a crazy ham-fisted attempt to torpedo the Goodreads ratings of other authors, but because she is a white woman and some of the authors she was targeting were not. And that includes Molly Chang, who is Chinese. Okay, so very specifically, this is going to matter later. Molly Chang was born in China, and she didn't learn English until she was 13. And most importantly, she's Manchurian from a city called Harbin. So although she has some Han Chinese, and so I'm going to start that over. So although she has some Han Chinese ancestry, everything I found online shows she identifies as Manchurian. And that makes her a member of an ethnic minority in China because the vast majority of the population there are Han Chinese. Okay, and now I'm going to give you guys a mini history lesson, which I'm going to get through as fast as I can. Manchuria is in the far north of China. Chang City, Harbin, is further north than North Korea. And in the Chinese context, Harbin is a kind of a weird place because it was actually founded by Russian settlers who went there to build the railroad. So when the Russian Revolution happened, white Russians, not the drink, the fallen Russian aristocrats, fled there in huge numbers, and it became the largest Russian enclave in the world. So then there's a decade or so of political maneuvering between the Russians and the Chinese, but then that comes to a grinding halt because the Japanese invaded Manchuria in 1931, and they turned it into their own puppet state.
Okay, I assume this did not go well for the Manchurians.
It did not. And I'm going to skip the grim details of exactly what the Japanese did in Manchuria and in the rest of China throughout the 1930s and up through the end of World War II, because it's really pretty gruesome. But the one thing you need to know, because it's relevant to this story, is Harbin was the location of this infamous thing called Unit 731. And so Unit 731 was the bad place. Okay, it was run by a guy named General Shiro Ishii, a combat medic officer who was basically like Joseph Mengele, except Japanese. And it was a site of really horrific human experiments, biological, chemical weapons research, just horrible, horrible stuff. And ultimately, between 200 and 300,000 people died there.
Jesus.
So, yeah, you know, not great, not great. So Chang comes from a part of China that has this really distinct and unusual history of colonization. It was controlled in turn by the Russians and the Japanese. And if you were Manchurian, you might now say that it has been colonized by the Han Chinese, although depending on who you said that to, you might get some angry pushback because in China that would be a very controversial idea. All of this is to say this is the history that informs Chang's novel. So again, the novel is called To Gaze Upon Wicked Gods. And the novel isn't set in Manchuria. It's a fantasy world inspired by Manchuria, sort of like how Game of Thrones was inspired by 15th century England. And the story is about a girl named Ru Ying, who has magical killing powers. And in the story, her homeland is invaded by troops led by the evil Prince Antony, who finds out about Ru Ying's magical gift and kidnaps her and tortures her until she agrees to use it to help him, which is kind of fucked up, except that, as I understand it, this is also how Jesse meets all his girlfriends.
I think it's very cute that you think that Jesse has ever had a girlfriend.
But I want to make a horse joke here, but has that one jumped the shark?
Oh, no, you can make horse jokes. He's not here.
All right. In the context of why this is a young adult fiction drama, some of you have probably already guessed where this is going. In Chang's novel, Ru Ying and the evil prince fall in love, and then the story becomes a romance between oppressor and oppressed. And I want to be clear.
Oh, so is this sort of like when it's the Nazi Jew romances, which are apparently a thing?
Yes, yeah. That comparison.
And when I say a thing, I mean in young adult literature. I don't mean like in history.
You mean in your wildest fantasies? You don't have sex dreams about women. You do have sex dreams about Nazis.
Exclusively.
But not female ones.
No, definitely. Very butch. Yeah.
Okay. So if you are familiar with the weird contours of the YA world, which Phoebe, of course, you are, so you'll understand that it was controversial already for her to be exploring a plotline like this because, yeah, it is a power imbalance and that's problematic. And Chang explicitly marketed this book as a kind of an own voices story, which is to say it's like a story about marginalized or marginalized coded characters by somebody who shares the marginalization. She wrote a Twitter thread where she said that her book had been inspired by her Manchurian background. And what she wrote was, "To gaze upon wicked gods is inspired by the folklores of my grandparents, including my Siberian Manchurian grandfather's ghost stories of Manchuria, Old Siberia, and Unit 731, and all the ways we are lucky to be alive." And this actually may have been kind of a mistake, because a lot of advanced readers seem to have interpreted that tweet in the context of the novel as Chang saying that she had essentially written a romance between a Manchurian peasant and a Japanese war criminal. And if you go on Goodreads today, you'll see a lot of one-star reviews and people using one phrase over and over, and that phrase is colonizer romance. And this is where the drama kicks off. So I have a representative review from a Goodreads user named Nahid Pico, which is fun to say. And this really sums up the complaints, but I need one of you to do a dramatic reading of it because I feel like I'm talking too much.
So you're telling me this book, which is marketed as an enemies to lovers romance, a romance that they want us to root for, to the point where we even got Antony's point of view, and he mentioned how he loves her, and she even knows he loves her and stuff, is doing Unit 731 against her people? I wanted to throw up. I feel like I'm being gaslit and going crazy. How are people rooting for this romance? How is anyone marketing this as a romance? How are tropes being mentioned regarding this romance when Antony's literally doing a disgusting, genocidal, torturous act against her own people? There is nothing excusable about that, as if all the horrible shit he did to her before this wasn't enough, including fucking electrocuting bracelets, kidnapping, blackmail, etc. I feel like even the bad reviews about this book aren't talking about the experiments analogous to Unit 731 enough. Like, hello, I am being gaslit. Okay, so just to be clear, that was in all caps, that I am, hello, I am being gaslit.
And that was the end of the quote, you are not being gaslit.
Oh, I am.
Stop gaslighting us about being gaslit.
All right, so a question for you guys. How much romance have each of you read in your lives? Any?
Some. I mean, enough, you know, I had the dog-eared copy of Flowers in the Attic underneath my bed, same as every other woman of my generation, I think.
Not really any. I think my father's mother would read a bunch of this, so I am aware of it as a genre, but
I mean, I think it's possibly the best-selling genre of all time. But my question is, and you two might not know the answer to this, I would assume, though, that romance between a captor and a captive is probably a fairly common trope.
Yes, I would say so. I mean, just based on, like, the covers alone, when you think about, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure I've seen some like hot Nazis on covers of Danielle Steele books at the grocery store before.
Did you?
Okay, maybe not Nazis.
Those are the ones that Phoebe wrote under a pen name.
That would be very awkward with my job at the Canadian Jewish News if I had a secret second job in that realm.
I'm working on the New York Magazine expose about that right now. Phoebe, you are going to be so canceled. It's your time. It's your time. Okay.
This will be great for your podcast.
But all right. So long story short, Nahid's Pico obviously did not enjoy this book, found it deeply problematic on a number of fronts. And she's not alone. There are a lot of reviews like this, or well, several, I shouldn't say a lot. They're posted in January or February of this year, and they are mostly gripes about the colonizer romance, the Unit 731 parallels. This one was posted in January, and it is thorough. It is 2,839 words long. And in addition to the unhappiness with the tropes, she also complains about the writing style and specific plot points. So all this is to say, this is actually quite different from Kate Corain's fake reviews, which were nowhere near as detailed and clearly were not done by somebody who had actually read the book. This person clearly did read the book. And so this is where Chang really did mess up, because she should have left this alone. I don't know. Are you guys familiar with the kind of conventions surrounding Goodreads, that like authors are not really supposed to interact with reviewers except to like tout their reviews, mm-hmm. maybe?
No, I don't spend time on Goodreads. It seems okay. Too insane. I spend the time on Kiwi Farms and 8chan, never Goodreads.
Yeah, where it's healthy and, exactly. And everybody's a gentleman.
There's a lot of etiquette on Twitter about if somebody negatively reviews your book, you're not supposed to, you know, start doing a big 1 of 500 thread at them about why they're wrong.
Right. And if they tag you in it, you're supposed to pretend you didn't see.
Right.
So Chang should not have called attention to this, but for whatever reason, you know, maybe she got out over her skis, or maybe she just had PTSD from the whole Kate Corain thing. In late February, she started tweeting her concerns about quote unquote fake reviews on Goodreads. And she wrote, "I don't know if this is Kate or a racist copycat who is out to harass me, but since this isn't the first time I was targeted, I'm a little paranoid. So if you've genuinely read the book and enjoyed it, can you please leave a review / rating to neutralize any further star bombing?" This was a huge mistake. Katie, you mentioned Kiwi Farms. There's a phrase they have over there, right?
Something don't about touch poo the poo. Or,
yeah. Okay. Chang touched the poo. She touched it. Goodreads is, as I've mentioned, it's an intense place. It has its own very kind of like bespoke etiquette. And even though it is marketed as a place for readers to connect with authors, readers do kind of tend to see it as their safe space. And it is then a huge norm violation for an author to draw attention to negative reviews. So now everybody who had already left a negative review sees this from Chang. They're like, she's saying we're fake. She's saying we're racist. They start posting updates to their reviews saying that she's targeting them for harassment, that she's trying to silence her critics. So then other people start leaving one-star reviews on that basis, and now you have an actual review bombing campaign. And then on March 10th, our friend Nahid's Pico posts an update with a very serious accusation of authorial misconduct. Phoebe, you were very good when your first dramatic reading. Would you like to read this one too?
Edit, March 10th. Why is the author attempting to dox me? I've always been a private account. And then there's an upside down smiley face.
Which is like the opposite of being happy, I guess. Oh no, that's a frown. I don't know. Do we even know what the upside down smiley face means?
World is upside down. That makes sense.
So did she really try to dox her?
So okay, before we get to this part, we do need to talk a little bit about who Nahid's Pico is.
Wait, are we going to dox Nahid's Pico?
Yes. No. That would have been really fun. But she kind of doxed herself, or at least insofar as revealing anything about your identity online is doxing. So she's anonymous on Goodreads. But after this, she very dramatically revealed herself to be one Sidra, a.k.a. Sid the SFF Kid, on Instagram. She is a small Muslim book reviewer on Instagram.
She's a small person?
I have no idea. She might be.
Petite?
I could not say. I don't want to spread rumors about the size and stature of Nahid's Pico. So what I will say is, when I say small, I mean she's a small account. She has like a few thousand followers. She posted a statement on her Instagram about this whole controversy. And the statement claims to be on behalf of an anonymous group of unknown number of BIPOC book reviewers who are upset about Molly Chang's behavior. And I assume that that's going to be in the show notes if anybody wants to read the entire thing. More interesting, though, is that on that same post, she wrote a really long caption claiming that she was terrified, like shaking, crying, throwing up, because Molly Chang was trying to dox her and attack her and her sister, who is an author. So now things are getting really sorted. Phoebe, I have more for you to read. I have sent you excerpts. Can you do a dramatic reading of some of this comment section?
Absolutely. The TGUWG author used her personal influence to smear and drag my sister's name, career among the author community during my sister's debut week. And there have been private confessions to it through a mediator proxy. There are multiple witnesses to this behavior too. The TGUWG author has a major deal with a huge following. Okay, so can I just interrupt to say that I feel like I just was doing a vision test?
Is that the name of the book?
To Gaze Upon Wicked Gods.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. Suddenly I thought like, are they going to tell me I need glasses, but only on one side?
Yes.
Okay. And then it continues, I will not stand for this bullying and harassment against my sister's career when she's a far smaller and Muslim author. Dot, 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 a bunch of dots. I don't know how many dots these are.
Don't read the dots. That was for a dramatic pause.
No, I thought you read the dots.
No.
I thought you were supposed to read each dot individually. Okay, and this is right before Ramadan.
During Ramadan. It's the new during Pride Month.
It might be my favorite part. Katie, as a Muslim, this must be really, it must hit you really hard.
I'm triggered, offended, and hungry.
Okay, so this is where things start to get really convoluted if they're not convoluted enough already. As I understand it, Molly Chang got in touch with a mutual friend privately to find out the identity of Nahid's Pico, aka Sidra, the science fiction fantasy kid. And it's hard to say why she did this. Maybe she really did still think that it was Kate Corrane with another fake account. I don't know. But when Sidra found out about this, she was really, really mad. And she posted some screenshots of herself texting about this with the mutual friend that she mentioned, saying things like, "But dude, why is Molly getting involved in reviewer spaces? This is not okay. This is extremely unethical. Does she not realize she's setting dangerous standards?" And then there's another one where she says, "Why is she reading her reviews?" As an author, I can probably answer that question. But, and why is she trying to find out their identities? And
this sort of seems like a when food reviewers go and like wear wigs to a restaurant that they're reviewing.
Oh my goodness.
Which actually makes sense. This doesn't.
Yeah, it's like I don't know. It's why is she reading her reviews?
Right.
Why are you Googling yourself? Why are you attending your own funeral? But things then get even wilder because there are also a bunch of screenshots in this array from Sidra's sister, who you'll recall is an author, having a conversation with a mediator who tries to explain Molly's side of things. And this mediator was none other than Zeron J. Zhao. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because she has been featured in all three BarPod book drama episodes in the last 4 months.
Old friend.
She is the Kaiser Sose of online book drama. She's got her hands in everything.
So I want to make sure I've got all this straight. So Molly Chang tried to privately figure out the identity of this reviewer, Sidra, for unknown reasons. And then Sidra accused Molly of trying to dox and harass her family.
And right before Ramadan.
Thoughts and prayers.
And then Zhiran J. Zhao steps in to mediate this drama between Molly and not Sidra, but Sidra's sister?
Yes. Okay. So that part isn't really relevant to the main controversy, but it's the source of some pretty amazing content that shows just how absurd and high school these dramas can get. There's a whole series of screenshots between the sister and Zhao that read like something out of a burn book, and my favorite is out of context. The sister saying, "It also just feels racist that I would be desperate enough to be jealous of her."
Did Molly explain her side of things ever?
Yeah, she did. And I'm not going to bother to quote from that because at this point it's all kind of tedious. But long story short, it seems like she was not actually trying to dox anyone. Her communications were all in private messages. And she wrote this explanatory note where she didn't even name Sidra. She just keeps referring to, quote, the author, as in the author of the Goodreads review, and the sister, as in the sister of the author. But this is just a side note, ultimately, to the main crux of the drama. Because remember, we still have the problem that Molly X. Chang wrote a colonizer romance. And this is where things got even worse for Molly, because now other Chinese people, like Chinese from China, started hearing about her book. And so we remember Molly's Manchurian. She's an ethnic minority in China. You guys may be aware, ethnic minorities, not super well treated in China.
I've heard that.
There are no stickers up about that in Toronto. So I actually, there's only one issue as far as my neighborhood's concerned, but interesting to note. I'll Google it later.
If only a paraglider had been involved, maybe.
Exactly.
You know about this.
Probably not.
According to Molly, once this controversy broke out of the YA Twitter sphere, she started getting attacked by Chinese nationalists, Han supremacists, Asian incels, which are even worse than regular incels. Unlike the doxing thing, here the source of the controversy is actually just straight up bullshit. People are accusing her of writing a Unit 731 romance, which again, she did not do. But it doesn't matter because now this rumor is running absolutely wild, including in Korea, where people have their own strong feelings about the Japanese occupation. And I have to say the Korean response to this book makes YA Twitter look like tiny amateur babies. Somebody wrote a post about it on this big Korean website, and I'm guessing at the pronunciation here, it looks like it's the coup. The translated comments say things like, there will soon be a novel about dating Hitler. And
I'm pretty sure there already is.
Yes, there actually is. Or no, not Hitler, sure. But Nazis. Maybe?
Yeah.
Ooh, okay. Untapped fan fiction potential. One of you guys, get on it. Phoebe, this is your next supermarket book.
I'm taking notes.
Okay. So then another one wrote, even if that writer gets shot, I have nothing to say.
Wow. It's
charming. And then there's another one that says, even though the author is of Chinese descent, she is still American. The author's parents and grandparents probably know this history, but I guess she grew up without receiving education at home. And I'm highlighting these comments because what they illustrate is that at a certain point in a controversy like this, the truth just completely stops mattering to anyone.
Yeah.
Like, these people are just convinced that the novel is a Unit 731 romance, which it's not. And they've convinced themselves that Molly Chang is Chinese American. When she's not. She's Chinese from China, and she actually lives in the UK now.
So this you see actually, I think, a lot online, people assuming that everybody is in America talking about America, and as the resident Canadian, even though I'm also American, I just have to say it's a thing.
It's online. Canadian erasure, honestly.
Yeah.
Up in Canada, do you guys have your version of like Ian Miles Cheong, like someone who lives in Malaysia who's just absolutely obsessed with Canada?
No, we just have Canadians who are absolutely obsessed with America. Thank you. That was a cue. That was like basically a cue. Yeah. Yeah. My good friend.
Yes.
Friend of the pod, right?
That's
what we say. Okay. I have one more Korean take to offer, partly because it's just incredible, like for just galaxy brainedness, and partly because Phoebe, I think that you're going to especially appreciate it. And I want to thank Jessica, the 80s baby in particular, for digging this up for me. The comment is, if Norman Finkelstein got banned from academia for telling truth about Gaza, you won't see me shed a single tear over a colonizing fiction getting panned.
Okay, so one day Norman Finkelstein is going to write a YA novel, definitely including Hitler in it, and that's what's going to bring peace to the Middle East. So that's what I'm holding out for.
The Hitler romance we've been waiting for.
Oh, God, I can't wait to read it. Okay, so now we are finally coming to the end of this story. Things are really spinning out of control for Molly Chang at this point, right? Goodreads is mad at her. Korea is mad at her, and extremely online Chinese incels are sending her messages accusing her of having racialized rape fantasies and saying things like, Xi Jinping should send agents to execute this bitch.
He might do it.
I know, like really kind of playing with fire on that one.
Yeah.
And this is the sad part of the story, though, not because she was executed. Wouldn't that have been amazing? Not amazing, like good, like, but just amazing narratively. But no, she ended up spoiling her own book to try to get people to back off and leave her alone. So eventually she got on Twitter and she explained that the book features an unreliable narrator. And then she revealed that the sequel is entitled To Kill a Monstrous Prince, which does suggest that the heroine and the evil prince are perhaps not going to be having a colonizer romance happily ever after.
Ugh, bummer.
Yeah, sad for them. I was really rooting for those crazy kids. But the people who are outraged about this book don't care about any of this. And if they're paying attention, they're not going to stop being mad, because at this point, it's not about Molly Chang or about To Gaze Upon Wicked Gods. It's really about the people who see her and her book as an avatar for whatever their kind of pet most hated thing is, mm-hmm. whether it's colonizer romances or authors misbehaving on Goodreads. Some people even accused her of grooming young women by writing a, quote, colonial rape fetish book that, quote, will absolutely cause real-world consequences.
I'm just going to assume, because these are YA books, that all of these reviewers are 9 to 10 years old.
But this whole thing about the, think of the impressionable young women, that's not a new line of argument, right?
No. Like, there have actually been versions of that complaint swirling around forever. People were like, flowers in the attic will normalize incest. And there was a thing about video games. It was like, oh, Mortal Kombat, like, kids are going to try to really rip each other's spines out and, like, eat them. So criticism like this is annoying, but it's kind of... like, it's kind of classic. You see it a lot, and it's not going to sink a book. And what's interesting is that it actually does take a lot to sink a book at this point.
Yeah. So what's the status of this one, To Gaze Upon the Wicked Gods? Is it canceled, or was this actually good for sales?
So we won't know for a little bit, because the book is not out yet, how it's selling. But thus far, it is not canceled. And this is, I think, the optimistic part. I think we are seeing a little bit of a vibe shift, as we were discussing at the very start of this episode, not just in terms of how we receive Me Too stories, but also when it comes to canceling stuff, even in YA.
You know, in the world of YA, I suppose this is probably what passes for a happy ending. I mean, nobody ended up in an institution. Nobody ended up canceling her own book. The author merely had to spoil her own book before publication to get everyone off of her back. Well, thank you for this, Kat, and thank you both for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. This was great.
Check out Feminine Chaos at femchaospod.substack.com. This has been Blocked and Reported. Our show is produced, as always, with help from Tracing Woodgrains and Jessica, the 80s baby. I'm Katie Herzog, and we'll be back next week with a new guest host. Oh, wait, it's not new, it's Helen.